it is anyway, so it's fine.
Yeah.
Let me just punch this out. Oh no, I'm gonna go live anyway. I forgot to add a title on the Facebook live stream, so it didn't like that. Anyway, we are live. Welcome everybody to Brain Food Live on Air. This is episode 47. Episode 47, I think it's episode 6, I believe, of season 2. And we're delighted to bring you Brain Food Live across multi-channel again. So we are broadcasting, hosting it on Crowdcast. I'm delighted to be here. So the folks who are watching Crowdcast, hello. We are also broadcasting this simultaneously in the Facebook group and also on LinkedIn Live. So just a quick shout out to the people on those groups. If you're on Facebook, can you just sort of comment very quickly on the live stream to make sure I can that you can hear me? Just say yes, I can hear you, Hung. And same with the folks on LinkedIn. If you're watching this on LinkedIn, just do a quick comment or like us know whether you can hear what we're saying. So that would be great. Okay, so on to the show. Firstly, let's have a quick word for our sponsors. Episode 47 is sponsored by our good buddies at Applied. Anybody who's seen this product is going to be massively impressed by these. They are a diversity and inclusion focused assessment software. They've got a really interesting technology about how do you assess people's capability in a non-biased way. So I absolutely recommend you check them out. They are a UK business, and I think they're going to go far in our industry, led by Kate Glazerbrook, who is a super smart person, and I think someone who people should be following as of course. Anyway, I'm very excited today because once again, Adam Gordon has been upgraded, and he's been upgraded significantly because we have my good friend and diversity and inclusion and belonging expert, Joe Lockwood, joining us for the show. Joe, it's an absolute pleasure to welcome you on Brain Food Live.
Hi, Hung. Yeah, it's an honor. I mean, thank you for inviting me on, and thank you to all of the guests tuning in for their time and appreciation to listen to what we've got to say today.
And it's been not before time, Joe, because, you know, I've been wanting to get you on the show for lots of different times and lots of reasons, because every time I speak to you, you've got something to teach me. This is going to be a fascinating topic. And thank you for helping guide me through this. I've got to be honest with you. D&I is kind of an interest of mine, but it's not I'm by no means an expert. I've never advised anybody on this. So I'm approaching this very much as an enthusiastic amateur, so to speak. So thank you for helping me navigate this topic and how we go through it. But before we kick off, just to introduce yourself quickly to the audience, who you are, what do you do, what is your business? I think folks might want to hear that.
Okay, well, in a nutshell, I would describe myself as an inclusion and belonging specialist with a passion for transgender awareness and transgender inclusion. So I work with businesses all over the UK, Europe and elsewhere. Predominantly, I do a lot of keynote speaking at conferences. I run workshops and seminars. I do a lot of guest podcasting, guest blogging. I'm now hosting my own podcast called Inclusion Bites, which is going to go live at the end of the month. I engage with companies predominantly around their inclusion and belonging strategy, working with people like Applied, CultureAmp, and looking at employee engagement, employee experience, and encouraging people to think differently and challenge the incumbent thought process on why the monoculture doesn't work.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. By the way, feel free to share the link to your podcast in the chat stream there, Joe. Make use of the chat stream there. Make sure people are aware of what you're doing and people can follow you on
that. Let me put my website in there for now.
Yep.
Podcast isn't live yet, so I don't really want people to find it by mistake until I've made it work properly. Yeah,
indeed so. Okay, so let's kick off on this. Firstly, we always kick off by reviewing Brain Food from last week. So, recruiting Brain Food is a newsletter, obviously, I do every week. Folks should feel free to sign up to that, by the way, if you haven't already done so. Joe, did you read last week's issue, and if so, what did you find interesting?
I did. I did read it, and offline we chatted about this, and I made some notes. So let me just fire up my notes that I took just so that I get it recorded correctly. Yeah, I thought it's a very interesting article. There's a lot of good insight, as always, on brain food. And I'm always drawn, obviously, to the D&I, the HR type content. But the one that sort of struck me first was, as I was going down it, is the Workable article where they mentioned GDPR. So I'm not looking specifically just at the content of what Workable posted, but GDPR in general, when you put a D&I lens on it, in fact, in all territories, when you think about the global need for data privacy, data security, territories around the globe have different rules and regulations on what data you can hold on people. So from a D&I perspective, that creates some challenges where we want to know who we employ, who we're getting into our pipeline, what we can hold on our employees. Then we've got further complexity about tenancy of data, where we hold that information as well.
You know what, Joe, that's actually one of the reasons why I need to get you on the show more, because this is an aspect of GDPR and data privacy I hadn't actually properly considered. Because obviously, the general idea behind GDPR and CCPA, which is, the California rule, which is obviously something that US companies are now adopting throughout the states, is all about let's protect the user. And that means typically anonymization, and it typically means rights to delete and all that type of stuff. But at the same time, companies that care about D&I typically need to have data about their workforce to understand, where they're at. So if we're in a situation where the users are starting deleting sort of the information that companies actually need to support a D&I initiative, there's a challenge there that probably we haven't anticipated, or at least the lawmakers, when they first invented or thought about GDPR. In fact, all we know that laws are typically 10, 15 years baked in. So back in those days, probably D&I wasn't even a topic of interest. No. So now this is rolled out. It's probably one of those effects that wasn't anticipated. But yeah, very interesting how we wrestle with that. I believe, by the way, the webinar of Workable has already been published. You can watch that on replay. Just sign up to it. It's on the last newsletter there. They had a CCPA lawyer to talk about what the implications are for data privacy. So definitely worth a review there. Cool.
Yeah, and I think that is the challenge for organizations working across the globe, how they collect data, because, and also how they balance some data you can collect, some data you can't collect. So it's trying to get a global view of their workforce can be tricky. And I know that, that's one of the challenges that many global D&I leaders have. And GDPR is there to protect us, but it also hinders corporate efforts sometimes.
I think absolutely it does. And let me tell you this, I remember now, it's been a long time since I've been involved in a company as an employee, but I remember when I was filling those forms in, they were collecting ethnicity data at the time. And I was always one of those that was do not respond type of people, with a little bit of a vague view of, why is this relevant? I want to be private. So I think, if that sentiment is kind of now legally expressed in stuff like GDPR, then I think this becomes much more tricky for companies to actually understand, where they stand and how do they collect that data without with consent. So that's definitely a topic that's worth a deeper dive into. Okay, cool. What else is interesting, Joe?
It's the next article about how McKinsey destroyed the middle class. And again, I'm putting my lens on this from a D&I perspective, not necessarily addressing the entire article as such, but it made me think about in the D&I space, we have all of these kind of sayings, diversity. Parties and dancing and music, inclusion to this, and we have all these sort of like mantras we kick out, and you're always going to see a slide with McKinsey on it where we know that diverse companies are X percent this, Y percent that, and 20% more efficient and more likely to retain staff. And I've started to hear CFOs and corporate people pushing back on this, going, well, that's what does that mean to me? It's all well having these numbers in the air, but they're so kind of mythical. Does anyone actually realize the benefits of these? So how can organizations take the power of diversity, take the power of inclusion and belonging and employee engagement, and make it real to them, not just about quoting these stats all the time. I think we get stats out, you know, and we need better stories rather than stats sometimes.
You know what? That's actually a point that Vessi Tashayev made as well in her report, which I want to talk to you about a little bit, because you went to that event, didn't you? Let me actually just share that with the crowd there. This is a brilliant report, by the way. I totally recommend you check this out. But she did mention, I read it just now just as a quick primer for this show, and she did actually say, when she was interviewing these CEOs about where they're at, how do you justify D&I, she mentioned that a majority of the CEOs actually did quote McKinsey. It was almost like, okay, the article on Brain Food, by the way, last week was all about the cultural power that McKinsey had. We all know they invented the term war for talent, and then suddenly everyone adopted that as a theory without maybe challenging it, because, you know, do you really challenge McKinsey? They're smarter than us. You know, that's the kind of feeling we have. And it's a very important point you make, in the sense that, yes, we're very reliant on a few consultancies to almost do the research, but we often underestimate how real that is, maybe, and also that it is agenda-driven. So the thrust of the Atlantic article, it's a brilliant essay, by the way, on how McKinsey destroyed the middle class. It's obviously a criticism of McKinsey, so a bit of a polemic piece. But at the same time, it points out to the fact that McKinsey had a vested interest in describing the flaws of middle management, because they were the consultants that came in there to cut those folks out. They became, you know, the people that would be employed or contracted in at exorbitant rates in order to make middle class redundant, middle management redundant. And they then link it to, you know, the decline of the middle class overall. So, to your point, Tim, exactly right. McKinsey consultant, typically, you know, again, typically non-diverse, it has to be said, you know, they're kind of from a certain background, from a certain school, will look and speak a certain way, and they will deliver the McKinsey way. So we don't get ethnic diversity, we don't get neurodiversity, we definitely don't get kind of solutions type of diversity either, because they're all coming from that playbook. Mm. They're too young, if you like, to know anything else. So I think very, very important point. By the way, if anybody's a McKinsey consultant watching this, please do comment. I'd love to get you on and have a chat. Like, tell us what it's all about. I don't know. I'm not a McKinsey guy. I'm just trying to, you know, go on the back of these articles that have been circulated.
But we've got to be careful also, Hung, in that, you know, you picked out that phrase, the war for talent. That's a very male-biased way of describing things. A war, fighting, battle. Right. They're male bias type phrases, and they conjure up a kind of a feudalistic approach sometimes. I think those don't always resonate with everybody.
Well, metaphors are massively important. You know, they often condition how we think of a certain thing. And I've always looked at metaphorical wars and realized there's almost never an example of a metaphorical war that's actually worked. You know, war on drugs, has that worked? No, of course not. You know, war on criminals doesn't work. War on whatever, you know, let's keep wars war, you know, let's not metaphorize this terrible incident. It's a serious matter. It's almost trivializing it to say it is such a thing. But again, it's an example of the cultural power of a huge consultancy like that. And, you know, I'm not criticizing them per se, because they do a lot. But let's also remember that they are a for-profit consultancy. Like every business, they're going to do help them make the profit. Anyway, read the post. It's awesome. And also read Vessi's D&I report. Yes. That is also awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. One more thing, Joe, before we get into the meat of this. What are the things in
Britain? I like the article. Let me just get the exact wording. It was 100 true fans or worse to that effect, wasn't it? It was the...
Oh, yeah. Cool.
I love the idea of this... being able to create your own brand, create your own super fans, build a niche, work out your value, and then mobilize your fan base to return that value. And it's very interesting. I mean, I like to think that in the modern world, we're more appreciative of the power of social selling, brand presence. We've got YouTubers, Instagrammers, really, you know, leveraging the power of their fans and amplifying their content, and it really resonates with me as a as an entrepreneur, startup, getting into the market now, about how I should think differently about my podcast, my channel, and really just hone down who is my audience, who am I talking to, and then put my effort into the people that are going to be my super fans, not everybody. Yeah. And it's really been laser focused now to try and leverage the brand value.
Yeah, I mean, just again, I've just shared the link there. It's from Andreessen Horowitz, and that's actually written by a lady called Lee Jin, who's a young analyst for Andreessen Horowitz. And you know what? She's kind of owning this space in terms of what this this type of business is. She calls it the passion economy, and she's basically saying, look, this is the Tim Ferriss way of doing business. You know, can you be like super passionate on a fairly narrow topic and get a load of people that might be interested in this fairly narrow topic and then monetize off that either you directly via subscriptions or through sponsors who want access to that audience? And I've been reading some of her stuff. And the reason why it resonated with me, because I think it's actually an avenue for a future of work that's available for some people. You know, we're all looking at what work is going to look like 5, 10, 15 years in time. Increasingly, being a full-time on-site employee is receding as an optimal choice for a lot of people. And it's certainly that's the case for me. So autobiographically, I was interested in this. But then I started reading some of Lee's stuff, and it became kind of fairly apparent that maybe the journey that Recruiting Brain Food is on track with this. I'm super passionate about recruitment. I'm super passionate about recruitment content and how can we, you know, cut through the noise and get the good stuff. And now Recruiting Brain Food is, of course, a media business. And it just strikes me that it is very similar to how she described it. Mm. And I think this is a potential future for a lot of people that, number one, have a passion. Number two, have a way to connect to a semi-large audience. And from there, good things might happen. So please do read that post if you're interested in exploring this type of work. If you're on Twitter, do follow Lee Jin. She just talks about this all the time. She's obviously thought this is going to be a place where she's going to thought lead on. She's a very good synthesizer of this type of content. So do check that out. Okay, cool. Excellent stuff. Well, listen, Joe, the topic of the talk today of the show, should I say, is mainstreaming D&I. And I didn't want to be too prescriptive on what we're going to talk about today because this is not my areas of expertise. But one of the things I did want to kind of be a core theme of the chat is how do we get genuinely more people involved? I was actually at one of your events, Joe, one of the True Inclusion event. I think the first one you did, and one of the best talks I heard was, I forget the chap's name, but he was a fellow that came in and gave a great talk. And he was talking about, look, in order to really move the needle with D&I, it's got to escape from HR. It can't just be like a hobby topic for a subset of the business. It's got to be baked in throughout the business. How do we do that? One of the ways in which we have to do that is actually be more inclusive as to who's having the conversation. Namely, we need more white blokes involved in doing it. And that was a revelation to me. I heard that and I thought, wow, I didn't even think along those lines. So that's the main theme of it. But let's throw it over to you, Joe. In your experience as a practitioner and a consultant advisor on this, where's the state of play for us? Where is diversity and inclusion in 2020 as far as you see it?
Well, I often talk about, if you like, the evolution. So we wind the clock back a few years and we were talking about equality, weren't we? Do you remember when we had the DDA, Disability Discrimination Act, we had the Equal Pay Act, we had Race Relations Act. So we had all these different acts that were brought forward by governments from the 60s, 70s, 80s and beyond. And they all got rolled up into the Equality Act 2010, all those years ago. Mm. And at that point there, if you like, the traditional business model was worrying, it was about compliance, about conforming to legislative needs. The government had to legislate to organizations to force people to behave in a great way. And then organizations started to realize that then they had this equality and the need to employ everybody, but then they started focusing on diversity. And at that sort of stage, then we saw that the growth of the ERGs, the staff networks, the internal forums where people could collaborate, feel a sense of belonging. And then people started realizing that diversity is great, But we actually need to start inclusion, where inclusion really is where we how we make the people we have in our organizations, our customers and everybody feel that sense of belonging, which is where we're done talking. How do I feel about working here? What's my experience like?
So help me out with the terminology, Joe. It's a diversity is a description. It's almost like a quantifiable thing, isn't it? It's like the numbers of heads in the room.
Diversity is made up of sort of like three main sort of dynamics. So you've got who you are as you're born. So your ethnicity, your race, your where you come from, your sex, gender. So the final fundamentals about you as you are. You've then got the concept of your lived experience, the other dimension, your lived experience, who you know, who your circle is, the people you mix with. And then from that onwards, you've also got your diversity of thought, the way you think, the way you see the world. So you mix those three dynamics together. And those are the three, for me, the three parameters of diversity, not just your skin color, not just your lived experience, but also about how you think. So those three things come together.
Wow.
That whole dimension of a person.
Joe, I need to see a visualization of this. So in other words, because this is great, diversity is literally it's about the first layer. It's almost like morphology, isn't it? It's like, what do you look like as the raw bit? The second part is lived experience is what do you feel about it? You know, what do you feel about, how do you feel about these spaces, these topics?
How you're socialized, the biases, the likes, the hates, the loves that come into your life over the course of your lifetime. Yeah,
exactly. And thirdly is how you think. Because you can also, we also need to have diversity of thought. Because we can't be all singing from the same song sheet because it's a different song. You know, it's a different interpretation of the same song. We all have our own views in this. So super interesting. Someone needs to draw a graph on that.
I have a slide. Diagram. I can share it.
Share the slide. Share the slide. Yeah. Make sure you share it with the folks there and they get access to it. Okay. That's really, thank you for the history there.
Yeah. Go on. So that's kind of the diversity. So the inclusion element, I always define inclusion as how you make me feel by how you treat me. So how inclusion for me is a feeling. Do I feel included? Do I feel accepted? Do I feel tolerated? Or do I feel excluded? And that's down to how I feel. You could say, well, I'm including you. But for me, inclusion is about, it's holistic. You can't be a bit inclusive. You can't pick and choose. Well, this week we're doing race. Next week we're doing religion. The week after we're doing LGBT. We're all intersectional. We all have these multiple personalities of all our lived experience, all those three dimensions I talked about. So you can't treat people as categories without thinking about the holistic element of who we are. So, and then I also say that from my perspective, inclusion is an active verb to include. You have to go out there and say, I want you. I'm going to come to you. I'm going to embrace you. And I'm going to put my effort into it. Because we hear so often open door policies, whenever you're passing, you can step in. But that to me is a bit passive. That's not really an inclusion thing. I want you. I really engage with you.
All right. Let me underline that point because you've made two very important points there, Joe, which I want to just dive into and explore a bit further. Firstly, intersectionality. Can you just unpack what that term means? I think I've got a vague idea that it means that we are fully three-dimensional human beings. We can't just be categorized with a single label. But is that an accurate definition in terms of how it works?
There's, if you think about intersection, i.e. Venn diagrams, where we overlap makes our whole. But the intersectionality is a word and a phrase. It's far more than just a word. It was coined by a Black feminist called Kimberlé Crenshaw in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. And she identified that as a Black woman, she has far more systems of oppression at play than someone who is a white woman. And at that time, the white feminists were getting a lot of PR and press. So she identified as a Black lesbian woman. She was suffering not only sexism as a woman, she was suffering racism as a Black woman, and also homophobia as a lesbian.
Yeah, and I believe it's that lady. If it's not, by the way, someone correct me. I've just quickly Wikipedia'd the name, but But yeah.
It's Kimberly, yeah, Kimberly Crenshaw, yeah. And so intersectionality theory or the concept of it, it's about layers of oppression. And it's not just saying, well, I'm intersectional. We've got to hire for intersectionality. That's a misuse. It's understanding the systems of oppression, the power and the privilege, so that someone who is typical, and let's say in the UK, typical means white, male, straight, of a certain class, it holds the power. So the further you deviate from the typical, the more systems of oppression you have at play. And I sometimes call these pebbles in the rucksack. The more pebbles you have in your rucksack, the bigger your burden to show up to be yourself.
You know what? I think that's a very good analogy. The sort of Dr. Stephen Jones, I think you kind of saw his talk as well. Really fantastic description, and the way he delivers this is really good. I totally recommend people check this guy out. A fantastic speaker and thought leader on this. But he was talking about the difference here is if your normal behavior, quote unquote, is default, you don't think about it. It just recedes into what normality is. Mm. And as you say, Joe, the further you deviate from that, be it as you appear or be it as you think or how you feel, the further you deviate on those three parameters that you described, the more difficult it is to navigate the world, or you have more effort required to get the same result. And that needs to be recognized. So that's a really intersectionality. That's a really good a way of getting around that. But also how the term is used. It's not a characteristic of a person. It is a description of where multiple
privilege, where power and privilege
overlap in different ways.
Yeah, I'm more likely to suffer microaggressions, lack of opportunity. So as a woman. As a trans woman, I suffer more discrimination than a woman who's not trans, maybe than a trans man. A trans man has male privilege. I have female trans privilege or lack of.
Right.
So yeah, those things compound, and when we're using banter or overly sort of joking in the workplace, those multiple intersections can cause these microaggressions. And microaggressions are. It's the drip, drip, drip of feeling lack of self-worth, they compound and they limit your beliefs and they limit your opportunities.
No, I totally get what you're saying. And like you say, a lot of people that are in the default, let's say the majority, the people of power, and I would put class in there, that's very important. Mm-hmm. People, because I think particularly in the UK, how you speak, where you're educated, how what your economic status is from your parents.
First language is very powerful. Pass as a good English speaker.
All of these things are really elevated in UK society. You're probably not encountering these sorts of micro events that remind you that you don't belong or you don't quite fit. I mean, I came across a little bit of this myself, just online and Facebook and all the rest of it. And I'm not one of these people that would ever use the race card or anything like that. I've always been a little bit dismissive of that. In fact, you notice I never talk about my ethnicity. But there was a joke that somebody made online, about coronavirus and Chinese people and all the rest of it. And I just thought, that's really quite, he's made that joke without thinking, probably not a bad guy. But he's made the joke without thinking, but he's communicated to me quite clearly, do I need to think about my mum now? Because when she's out on the street, going out and shopping for groceries, do other people think that way? Do I need to start, doing the shopping for her because I don't feel that she's safe out here? So stuff like that you don't think about because it's not you. You're not affected. So I totally get what you're saying about these micro events sort of having impact.
I heard a great quote. Do you know Bruce Daisley? He ex-Twitter. I think he was a VP of some role in Twitter until recently, and I saw him at a Engagement Excellence Summit last week. And
what was his name again?
Sorry?
What was his name?
Bruce Daisley. He's a fantastic speaker. He was talking about employee engagement and excellence in that sphere. And he came up with this soundbite, and I thought was really powerful. So power is disinhibiting. Lack of power is inhibiting. So when you have power and privilege, you act without thinking. You don't feel that you have to think about what you say.
Yeah.
If you hold power in the office, you can put your feet on the chairs, you can put your feet on the desk. If you see someone on the train with their feet on the seats, they feel they've got a sense of entitlement, a sense of power. Where someone who feels they haven't got power, they haven't got any entitlement, they're going to recoil into themselves and they're going to be inhibiting their own ability to stand up for themselves. So we've got to recognize when we see people acting without regard, that's because they perceive they have power and privilege and they're not anybody else.
Let me just step in there because, again, you made a very important point, Joe, about the word privilege. Because I think a lot of people, when we float the word around, I've got a lot of white male friends. In fact, that's the dominant demographic of the people that I would say are friends for various reasons. Sometimes that can be prickly to them because they can say, look, I'm not privileged. Because the word itself probably has multiple connotations. When we think of privilege outside of the lens of D&I, we assume blue-blooded royalty or someone who's born with a silver spoon in their mouth and all the rest of it, these extreme examples of privilege. But in the formulation you've described, and actually from Bruce, I think that's exactly right. You basically, it's disinhibiting. In other words, you don't need to think about it. You just do it. And that's part of the issue because it's a subconscious thing for you. Therefore, it doesn't compute when someone says you got privilege. It never occurred to you you had privilege. Of course, one of the symptoms of it being privilege is that you don't think of it as privilege.
Another phrase I often use when I speak is that I say privilege is nothing to be ashamed of. So you shouldn't be ashamed of the privileges you have. You should acknowledge it. But to me, it's how you wield that privilege. If you wield it for the good of everyone, then you're using that privilege to society's advantage. When you use it selfishly or to the effect of people, that's when it becomes a misuse of privilege. So privilege as a word, if you wield it with passion, with care to support people, is a very powerful thing. And that's where we see people like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, you know, all these people plowing the philanthropic efforts with their privilege, Obama's, and even you can argue Harry and Meghan are trying to put some of their privilege back into the world. And I think that's when it does good.
Yeah, you know what? And I would cite a good friend of ours doing the same, Bill Bowman. You know, he is a white male, done great things in his career, all this type of stuff, but he's taken it upon himself to really put himself in the line of fire at times, even physically in the line of fire, you know? And that's an example of using his privilege position to take that type of action. So, hat tip to Bill there. Awesome stuff. Okay. One more point before we bring Neil on, because I want to speak to him about this exact topic. You talked about active inclusion. Now, I want to just sort of double down a little bit on this. I think it's super important because, again, a lot of people, and I would include myself in this, as default, I'm one of these to say, I'm not putting barriers in, but it's up to you to step through the door. But you're saying actually inclusion is an active term, and in fact, you need to step forward in order to welcome those folks in. So tell me where you encountered that idea and sort of where is this kind of built strength for you when you kind of first learned about it?
It's really hard to work out where all of my knowledge and thoughts come from, because I meet so many people and I think it's just an amalgamation of all the great speakers, all the great research I've read, and it's become internalized as my mantra, my thought process. But I came across this description about conscious exclusion or unconscious exclusion. So we do all this unconscious bias training. We spend millions on it globally. And the anecdotal evidence is it's not really making much difference because for all the stuff we've spent, we're still going through the same challenges. So what I encourage people to think of is rather than call it unconscious bias, let's call it unconscious exclusion. Let's then understand we do it. Then we can start stepping back and saying, okay, so now I know I'm doing it, even though without realizing it. How can I step back? How can I be conscious about my exclusion? So I know I'm doing it, and now I'm being conscious that I'm doing it, and now I'm having to justify to myself why I've said that, why I've thought that. So if you look in the recruitment space, we're looking at a candidate and not just saying, oh, I don't like the look of them, they don't sound right, gut feel stuff. We're looking at them going, consciously I'm making a decision, this person doesn't meet the spec because the role isn't suitable, then there's a whole number of dynamics where they're not capable of doing the role. So we're being very conscious about that act, and we're not using subjective terms. And then once we're conscious about why we're excluding people, we can then be conscious about including people. So let's start reframing. Let's start with okay, so if we hired this person, what would that look like? Or we can start questioning each other and asking each other challenging questions. Say, well, why are we doing it that way? Why are we doing it? And getting the culture in the organization such that we're not afraid to challenge each other. And you know, active inclusion was where we start opening up the conversation, saying, am I thinking logically? Who do I need to ask? Can I involve more brains in this? Can I get my neural network at play here? Do I need to ask people with a different ability, maybe a different agenda, different gender, different if they're disabled, if I'm designing a product, do I make sure I'm including all voices in that product? And it goes far beyond just the HR function. It's about product design, market testing, all those kind of things. We need to bring people into focus groups and understand it. You know, Patrick, the guy that was going to stand in for the Tory party leadership, he wanted to set up the People's Forum, didn't he? Rory Brimner. People's Forum, to try and solve the Brexit sort of debate, which obviously is a bit late now, but it's trying to get more brains into this and making it a people's thing. So I'm not saying you have to ask everyone's opinion, but by crowdsourcing and making sure you've got more data, more opinions through inclusion initiatives, that's when you're going to get better products, better support, be more relevant to your customers, and deliver the McKinsey stance.
You know what? And you brought Rory Stewart in. I don't want to get into the Brexit conversation, but I think in many respects, and I speak to a lot of people who did vote to leave and they're now enthusiastic about the future for the country, at odds, of course, with my position on this. But I wanted to speak to them and figure out what the thought process was. And it is actually the case where I think they felt excluded from the conversation, both politically and culturally. And this is their basically a reclamation of their place in society. I hope we'll find a way in which we can come to terms, because it is, as you say, it just underlines how important it is to include everybody in this chat. Which reminds me, it's time to bring some of our guests on board. Neil Morrison, who has been commenting on the chat stream and also published a really interesting blog. Neil's a really good writer, by the way. He wouldn't thank me for saying that, but he is. And he wrote a really good blog about how inclusion must include everyone, even if that means some uncomfortable conversations, which is the point, right? We need to get uncomfortable. And I think the broader theme of this is that if we decide not to include people based on their identity or for whatever reason we think that they don't have a say, then that doesn't push the marble forward. So I think this is in large part linked to what I learned in your event, Joe, that we basically need to make, even though it's counterintuitive, but we need to make sure that the default majority or the people who do have privilege right now feel that they can have an opinion and contribute to the conversation when it comes to D&I. So this is the thrust of the piece. But let me bring Neil on. He's actually, I believe, in a spa right now, so I'm a bit concerned about, you know, whether this is safe for work. But let's give it a shot. People under the age of 18 might want to avert their eyes until I give you the okay. But Neil, by the way, if you don't know him, Neil is kind of a HR director in the UK, working at the moment for Severn Trent, one of the biggest utility companies in the country, and previously done some amazing work with Penguin, Random House, and all the rest of it. There he is, Neil Morrison.
Totally safe for work.
Oh, yeah, I think you're totally safe. Actually, Neil, I'm a bit disappointed because you told me you were at a spa, and I'm thinking Roman toga, you know, some sort of like soft music in the background, all the rest of that stuff.
I left early just so I could be here.
Oh, mate, I'm honored and delighted, and also disappointed for you, Neil. So I want to make sure you're back there and enjoying your spa. But listen, I've just shared your blog post with the chat stream there. Really interesting to read it. Can you just describe what your feeling was when you wrote that and what the point that you wanted to make was?
Yes. So if I can start by saying I'm very aware as a white, middle-aged, middle-class man that when I talk about
can I interrupt? Sorry, is it possible to zoom your volume up a little bit on your mic? Yeah, I could be better. I mean, I don't know. Say something.
Shout.
Does that work? Is that any better?
And marginally, maybe it's just the case of sticking the mic a little bit closer to your mouth, I think.
Okay, should we try that?
Yeah, that's better. Yeah, that's much better.
Okay,
cool.
So what I was going to say was I'm very conscious that as a white, middle-aged, middle-class man, when I talk about inclusion, I am stepping into a world which, to some extent, I have not experienced some of the challenges that other people do. And so a lot of my observations are based on running organizations and trying to make them more inclusive and trying to help to make access to organizations better. And the blog post was really a sense that too often I find the world of inclusion anything but inclusive. It is quite divisive. It's quite it becomes overly granular to the point that different groups point at different groups, that we segment and fragment to an extent that I think we lose sense of what we're trying to achieve. And if we want to create genuinely inclusive organizations, for me, in some ways you need to get the people that hold power to seed power, and those are generally white men. And therefore, understanding their views, understanding their experiences, and being able to accept a perspective, even if we don't agree with it, is really important in order to drive change. And that's what I was getting at. And I think if you look in the politics in America, if you look in the politics of the UK, what we've seen is a reaction to probably more progressive liberal policies and politics over a period of time, which isn't going to achieve what we want to do. So how do you truly engage everyone into that debate? That was at the heart of it.
Yeah.
I've got the way I sort of talk about this is I talk about the privilege being a castle, you know, old fashioned Norman castle with the people on the ramparts and archers at the ready. And then you've got all of the peasants on the outside with their pitchforks and they're flaming this and that. And they're all trying to storm the castle to get access to the point of power. And all that happens is if you take this very feudalistic approach, the drawbridge gets pulled up and the people with the power and the privilege to just retreat into the castle and say, well, once you've sorted yourself out or had your battles, come and talk to us later. And I'm a great believer and we have to involve everybody, which is why I call inclusion is about being holistic. So we need to involve men in gender issues. We need to involve white people in race issues. We need to engage with everybody. I mean, I cast people's minds back to when women were voted back in 100 odd years ago. And if you look at the language of the time, men allowed women to vote because men had power, men had privilege, men had the control of the parliament. Therefore, men had to allow women to vote for women to vote. So I say the same thing now. In order for gender equality, racial equality, disability equality, all of the equality we seek, we have to involve the incumbent. And we also have to recognize that we can't demonize the white man. The white man has a high suicide risk, has a lot of stress. It's a tough game being a man as well. And it's not about blaming someone for having privilege. It's levering their privilege for the good of all and using their voice as allies, as enablers. And I certainly do not support silos of diversity, all pitching against each other, all competing for the same resources. And even within the same silo, we have hierarchy of passability, credibility. If your skin is too dark, too light, if you're a good-looking person, you're a bad looking person, if your disability is minor versus disability is major. There's a whole load of hierarchy in all communities. And I think it's about trying not to be divided and conquered. It's about being collaborating and succeeding together.
You know, Hung, go ahead, Neil.
See, I just want to, because I totally agree with everything that Joe's just said, and I want to come back to this point that keeps on getting raised when I talk about this, which is there are some views that just are not acceptable. Okay, so there are people who espouse hate or people who are, you know, so extreme in their views that we cannot allow that to be the case. And I don't disagree with that at all. I'm not saying that, you know, a very fervent fascist can come out and talk about, you know, the annihilation of a religion or a race, and we say that's okay. Of course I'm not. But I think trying to in somehow challenge the argument by saying you're going to an extreme in order to deny the fact that, you know, as Joe's just incredibly articulately set out, that we need to listen to voices is just dangerous. So there are extremes, of course there are extremes, but actually there are more people who aren't on the extremes, and it's about trying to encapsulate all of them together.
Yeah, you know what, I just want to step in on that, because and David, thank you for your commentary on this, by the way. David Galley, he's come out with some strong comments in criticism of the general tenor of the chat here. But Dave, I'd love to get deeper into what you're mentioning here, and at some point we'll do that. Let's talk about this idea of how do we kind of mobilize the power within a business so that diversity and inclusion does escape from the domain of HR. And I think, you know, involving the incumbent, as you mentioned, Joe, in your term, I think is a very good way of talking about it, because without including them, you're just going to set yourself up for potential stakeholders and supporters that you're already kind of setting up as enemies. Now, if you're running a business, the business is going to want to succeed in its own way. And if D&I turns into a kind of a niche topic that doesn't have widespread support in across the function, like real support, not just rhetorical stuff that people say and then get on with the operational day-to-day, you know, oh, we've done the D&I campaign, let's get on with business. And how do we actually bake it in? I think we do need to have all voices represented here. And you know what, David, the way I would deal with your comment on this, and by the way, I'm happy to get you on the show at another point to get your view on this. But I would say that we need to put the primacy on the idea rather than the identity of the messenger. I do get the sense that generally speaking that most people are pointed in the same direction when it comes to creating an inclusive organization. You know, very few people that I know have come out and said, you know what, no, you know, we're this type of business. Most people kind of think, of course, yeah, we want to make people feel that they belong to the company. They should perform better if they do feel that. And how can we kind of mobilize it so that it's more effective than just, you know, the odd topic here and there. So I wonder whether you've got any ideas on that, you two.
I guess the point about incumbents, I think, is really important. And I guess you've got three choices about how you get organizations to change. You've got those in power become allies and supporters and help to drive it. You've got legislation and regulation that comes in and forces it, or you've got some kind of rebellion or revolution where the organization's taken over from within. And you know, the latter is probably the most unlikely. So you end up with this bad organizations being regulated into doing it, and good organizations, I think, finding the champions and the role models. I don't know if that's your experience, Joe, as well.
Yeah, I like those three analogies. you say the third's unlikely. Actually, I think the third is potentially likely. It's market pressure. Market pressure will kill companies that don't relate to their client base. You know, they're not adaptive. They don't see the market coming. You know, some would argue that Mothercare didn't really focus on the future, and their board was probably too much the same, too much old school. They weren't thinking like mothers. They weren't thinking like modern people. They didn't have maybe enough age diversity on the board. So, yeah, I think the third option is realistic. Well, companies will just wither and die where they're no longer relevant. But I encourage organizations in a kind of post-conventional way to set their employee networks up with objectives. Why are they there? What are they there to do? Can they be a business tool, a business asset, so you can run ideas, you can have a shadow board with the ERGs, have a network of networks, pull people together, make sure senior leadership team involvement and sponsorship is at those things. I mean, these are all things that people are doing already, not rocket science. But I think we've got to you know, just take gender equality for one thing. You know, we talk about the 30% club, we talk about all this stuff, and people say, well, we're trying to get 20% gender equality. Is 20% good? I mean, people are patting themselves on the back for achieving it. Is that good? I mean, how long do we have to wait? Is it 2080, 2090, or whenever the current rate? Or do we have to do something really, really radical to bring all people in? Because we've got talent shortage, the world of work is changing, we need more adaptable people, we need people with different skill sets, the skill sets of the past are no longer going to exist. All of these kind of things we talk about all the time. So I'd like to see business embracing different sorts of people because of the different adaptability to different ways of working they'll bring.
Can I just say one more thing as well, just to support the point? Any study on millennials, the next generation coming in, and one of their priorities when they look at an employer is they're looking for diversity. So I think sometimes there needs a generational shift also. But there's no question that the generation coming into the world of work now put D&I very much at the top of their priority list. So, you know, companies that do want to hang around and, you know, have more than just a 12-month plan really need to embrace this as a critical concern if they do want to make sure they're hiring these types of folks.
Just to pick up on that, I talked about the dimension of being diversity of thought. We're bringing people into the workplace now that are thinking more about sustainability, so think about more about the environmental impact. So when I think about diversity of thought, I'm thinking about bringing these passions into the organization rather than just thinking differently about other things. But organizations need to start thinking about these sustainability things at core. And maybe the incumbents, the people who've been in the organization, maybe a different generation, don't have the same sort of impetus or imperative to make these drive these changes. So by bringing in these diverse people with these other thoughts, these other ways of thinking, that's going to influence the way we develop our business, the way we focus our mission and values as an organization.
Very good. Neil, I don't want to take too much more of your time because you are in a spa. I just want to, I feel really guilty. I just want to say if there's one thing, so the topic of the title is how do we mainstream D&I? How do we make sure it gets out of a silo and it's more widely accepted throughout the organization? Can you give like one practical tip that a HR leader or a recruiting leader or any kind of person in a business who cares about this, they can do? That would help push the marble forward here.
I think the connection for me is my job is about helping individuals, teams and organizations to perform better. That's what I try and do. I want my organization to perform brilliantly. And so I want the best talent and the best teams working together. Now, the chances of the best talent all being white males is incredibly unlikely, right? Statistically, it's just impossible. So the practical tip I'd give to people is really, if you really, really want the best, if you're really critical about talent and performance, then you want to go as far afield as possible from your kind of standard demographic, whatever that may be. It could be a predominantly white female workforce, for example, in some places. Go as far afield in order to find those. And it should be hard and it should be difficult. It shouldn't be straightforward.
Yeah, well, there's tooling to help with that. And actually, our sponsor of the show today applied at one of the there's a growing group of businesses, actually. There's this market segment of debiasing assessments and stuff like that. That's a growing segment. Companies care about it. And hopefully, this will unlock lots of talent pools that may not kind of easily pass through the traditional recruiting filter. So definitely, I think assessment tooling helps because it can open up a wider group of people for you to review, and then you just rely on the game-based testing, I think, Applied do, and then work out the talent from there. Okay, Neil, listen, I'm going to let you go because you've got, you know, your feet to be rubbed or whatever happens in spas.
It's happening right now.
Is it really? I don't want to hear about that. Listen, great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for your contribution. Have a good weekend and please keep blogging. I love the stuff you write and I know that you're brave enough to make him points that can sometimes guarantee that you're going to get comeback. We need those voices in there. It's exactly an example of diversity, I think, that we need to embrace.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Take care, Neil.
Cheers. See ya. Bye. Hung, can I pick up on Mitchell's comment there?
Sure.
Not always equal to constructive discussion and can be destructive, divisive, even if unintended. I see that sentiment a lot. And frustration often comes from lack of action from listening. You know, you engage with me, you ask me my opinion, then you ignore me. Of course I'm going to get frustrated. Of course I'm going to push back. And if you're not listened to enough, you end up with rebellion. And that this is where, you know, we get these destructive, divisive conversations. But I spend hundreds of hours a month meeting people, talk about D&I, sometimes in an echo chamber, sometimes outside the echo chamber, sometimes on the stage at conferences. And those conversations, I never feel are destructive or divisive. Because I think if you go in with open arms, go in with the right motivations, go in with a listening ear, listening to understand, not listening to reply, and we develop inclusive leadership styles and train organizations with those inclusive leadership styles, then we can have these conversations and we don't end up moving to a position of tolerance. And tolerance doesn't solve anything. Tolerance is basically backing off and putting rules in place. So yes, I think, yes, passion can be focused. Passion can be to the benefit, but the people with the power, people with the privilege do need to take some responsibility for listening. You said we did type strategies.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Mitchell, hopefully that's answered the question, but if not, then please do comment again. I think, you know, from reading just those two lines, I mean, I can see what that means. To a large degree, I think there's a valuable observation. You know, you can get people that are just totally into it, and sometimes that can be intimidating. When there is a discrepancy between passion, let's say, you know, if there's two people talking on a topic and one is like massively and explicitly passionately for one position, the other one may just be a little bit more neutral about it. Chances are that they're going to consider, fine, I'm not going to die on this hill, you know. So I totally get what you're saying there. We're running short on time, but I do want to bring one more guest on the show because you know what, David has actually helped articulate a few points which I want to kind of explore a bit further, because I do think there's also a diversity in terms of how we approach diversity from a cross-country point of view. I mean, there's clearly cross-cultural differences in how we deal with D&I. I think, for instance, the Americans, given the Americans' cultural power, generally speaking, they often are setting the frame and they're setting the conversation, and they kind of determine a huge amount of you know, the topic set that we talk about. However, every country has a different history, and every country's relationships are different, be it race, gender, variance of ability, all those types of things are different. So what I want to do is bring on a US recruitment leader. This is Tim Sackett. Tim has got opinions to share. I don't think he's afraid to share them. If he's still there, I will bring him on. We'll see what he has to say. Because, you know, is D&I different in the US compared to the UK? I don't know. I don't know whether you've done any work in the US, Joe, or you've interacted with businesses in the US context in this topic.
I have, and I've also, you know, as you know, we've been to Australia, been to Melbourne at RecFest there. I've spoken in Tel Aviv and Kiev and Tallinn and other places around the world. And everyone has a D&I challenge. The priorities and the sensitivities of the culture differ. The US, I wouldn't class myself an expert, but I perceive race is a major factor. And the diversity of race. We've got Islanders, we've got the Hispanic community, we've got lots of different racial elements within the US, and gender. When we talk about Me Too, we talk about the rise in the power of women. Those are the kind of, I perceive as being the big ticket items as far as the US is concerned. As I say, I'm not US, I can't speak for that, but that's how I perceive it. Whereas you look at someone like Kiev, and more eastern sides of Europe, then ageism is a big issue, where people are perceived as having no worth or value once they hit a certain age. And within Israel and Tel Aviv, I learned a whole lot of things about how they perceive non-native Jewish people versus people who are born there, people who've done national service, the different communities within the Jewish community. So each culture, each society around the globe has its own challenges of D&I.
Right, you know what? You've just explained it. I mean, absolutely. We need to also diversify D&I when it comes to cross culture, because you are absolutely right. And by the way, in Eastern Europe, Central Europe, there is an ageism issue, and it's very closely related to, are you pre-communist or post-communist? Because there's a different operating model. People are trained in a certain way. They typically speak a different second language. So if you go to Central Eastern Europe, for instance, anybody who is over the age of 40 will probably not speak great English, but they'll speak great Russian. Anybody under the age of 35, let's say, will speak English and superbly well, but not speak Russian. And there's a big cultural divide almost as a result of that. And again, that's a local condition, a local sensitivity that you wouldn't otherwise be aware of unless you were there and speaking to the people there. So it's an example, I think, where the sentiment or the impulse for diversity and inclusion probably is reasonably universal as far as it goes. You can imagine certain countries where it probably is not a topic or something you can't talk about. You know, I would imagine it might be difficult to have this conversation in Riyadh, let's say, you know, or you'd have a different conversation at the very least. But let's say countries that are European or plugged into the internet, let's say, they will have this topic, but the local conditions will be very, very important. And that's another thing that is, you know, I think the default position that I've got to is that I'm going to accept my ignorance. I'm going to own it, and I'm going to go forward with the view that I don't know, and then hope that someone can teach me. You know, not to say I'm going to accept their view, because it's not tabula rasa, and sometimes people who position themselves as experts might have problematic opinions themselves, and you can't just accept that. But at the same time, I think we have to be honest when we don't have the lived experience. We've got an instinct to universalize our personal experience as something that everyone shares, but it isn't. You know, it's very, very individual. Okay, well, it looks like Tim is struggling to get on. I don't know why we always have this. I think Crowdcast, or maybe even Brain Food, doesn't like Tim Sackett. I don't know why that is. But Tim, listen, I don't want you hanging around the rest of the day, because there's other stuff that you need to get on with. Let's fix this, because I definitely need to get you back on the show. By the way, Glenn Gutmacher, thank you so much for giving me the heads up on what's happening on Facebook. Everyone watching this on Facebook, I'm sorry, I'm not monitoring it. The reason why I can't, I'm just terrified of killing the live stream if I flick off this tab. But anyway, I'll go multi-monitor at some point and we'll figure it out. Anyway, we're coming to the end of the show. So thank you everyone for watching. I hope you've enjoyed it. It's been fascinating to explore. Actually, we've got through more material and ideas in this 1 hour, Joe, than I thought we might be able to do. We're going to try and write this up with the support of our friends at Green Umbrella, who've been doing these amazing blogs for us. So hopefully we'll be able to condense what we've talked about into a digestible post, which I'll share with everyone in the group and the chat streams, and we can reflect on this a little bit further. But it's been a fantastic show. Thank you everyone on the chat stream. Thank you everyone who's watching on LinkedIn Live. By the way, please do comment if you want to receive a copy of this post. I think we're going to PDF it out somewhere. Comment on the LinkedIn post if you want to receive it, and also the same on the Facebook stream. Okay, that's it. Thanks a lot to our guests, Neil Morrison, also Tim Sackett, who tried to get on and couldn't. Of course, thank you to our co-host, Joe Lockwood. Joe, it's been amazing having you. I'll definitely look to get you back on the show. And thanks again to our sponsors for the episode, Applied. They are a company that can help with a lot of the D&I stuff, particularly at the recruitment end of it, if you want to diversify your talent pool. Okay, we'll be back next week with episode 48. We're talking sourcing mentality with Aaron Lintz. We'll see you next week, folks.
See you there. Thank you. Bye.